Local treasure and award-winning literary gem, Joan Frank, joins Rosemary Manchester in a riveting conversation about Joan's work, the writer's life, and indeed life in general. Later in the broadcast, we'll bring you a literary calendar with Bart Schneider and his new press, Kelly's Cove, and Katie Kasbin, events director from Copperfields. But right now, let's listen to Joan Frank reading from her award-winning book, In Envy Country. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea.
This is from The Sun on the Ganges, the last story in the collection. Four people sat at dinner in a suburban home, and conversation turned to the days of the doctor's medical school studies in Bologna. It was a singularly happy time, the doctor told his friends, because of the civilized mien with which the professores conducted their business. Bologna is a jewel of a city, he told them. Wherever you turned, beauty laughed back at you. Beauty draped, beauty radiating, beauty strewn like shattered opals in careless brilliance. The pinkish walls of the porticos in diffuse sunlight, all marbly veneers and ancient cracks, the expanses of warm, flat-stoned piazzas and cooled, shadowed passageways, stunned the observer, ruining you for any other place. All their studies and exams were conducted in Italian, continued the doctor, whose name was William. And surprises, he said, ambushed you. It was not uncommon in the middle of an oral exam, as morning edged toward noon, said Will, for the professore to suddenly stop his student mid-recitation. Do you like pasta? The student would blink. You heard me. Do you like pasta? The professor would press his young charge. Of course the student liked pasta. And how do you like it exactly? With an Alfredo sauce, perhaps? Or maybe in a little butter with sliced garlic and shrimp and red peppers or sausage? A scrape or two of fresh Parmigiano Reggiano, coarse black pepper, a nice chunk of bread, and the olive oil to dip. By then the student would be salivating, nodding mutely. Watching and listening to Will as they sipped wine at the candlelit table were his wife Penny, who was a decorator, Mark, who taught history at the nearby college, and Mark's wife Reese, an office manager for a local computer outlet. Will imitated the professor's intonations with the flatly deadpan punches given Italian inflection of English by Americans who satirize it. Then we go to lunch tomorrow, eh? We do the exam tomorrow. And with that, Will told them, the grateful student and his amused examiner would repair to a good buca for a long, leisurely meal, to include some fresh antipasti, a nice Valpolicella, and finally syrup-strength espresso with a couple of serious cigars. They would at last bid one another fare you well and stagger off for a deep afternoon's sleep in their respective quarters, by which time, of course, it would have become evening and time to think about the coordinates of a lovely dinner. How you got through med school I'll never understand, snorted Reese, a rather sharp woman accustomed to taking daily charge of a number of odious chores that reproduced themselves constantly like a rampant mold. She brought her lunch every day and ate it while reading in the car. It was husband Mark who befriended people on ships and trains and airplanes, Mark who loved to entertain. He had convinced himself and Reese that he was born into the wrong country and the wrong era. He missed a polis, or town hub, where community gathered nightly. So they held regular dinners like this one, little substitute polises, with streams of guests from different portions of their pasts.
You've been listening to Joan Frank reading from a story called Sun on the Ganges from her latest story collection, In Envy Country. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea, and I'm delighted to have Joan Frank in the studio as my guest this evening. I've really been looking forward to this, Joan.
I'm so glad. I love radio. It's intimate, and yet you are aware that you're reaching people, and it's a very comforting medium.
Yeah, and I've had such a good time reading your books.
Thank you.
You write beautifully.
Oh, thank you.
And when you were reading and you said it was spreading like mold.
Mm-hmm. Those are analogies, and it's a kind of an affliction for me, as well as a as a gift to sort of default into thinking in analogies. I should tell you that my parents were both English teachers, and I grew up in a house packed with books and music and a lot of articulate language. They would have their friends over for inebriated parties, and everyone would argue politics and culture. And I couldn't help osmosing a lot of that. So I almost can't claim it as my own gift, more like one conferred possibly genetically.
It's a gift, but also you worked very hard to learn the craft.
That is true.
And to yes, and from your publications and the quality of your work. Really, you're just getting started, I think.
I hope so. People say a lot that, oh, you work hard. And it is technically hard work, but it is something that one has no choice but to do. One is bound to do. One must do, like eating and breathing. And so I have no sense of a beginning or an end, just a sort of a desperately urgent continuum that I'm always pushing.
Yes, and I saw a quotation from you that every time you start over.
You do. It is totally Sisyphean, Rosemary.
Yeah, but I could just see these books rolling from you as the years go by, and we can anticipate more and more of your writing.
Thank you.
Look forward to that.
I look forward to them too, because I honestly don't know what they're going to be until they arrive.
And you also say that sometimes you don't know what they are until your readers tell you.
That's true. Absolutely true. In fact, I have written about this, and people always ask two things when you give readings. They ask, number one, where do you get your ideas? Mm-hmm. And number two, how much of that story is true?
and then they ask, when do you write?
That's the other thing.
In the morning or in the evening? I know that always seems like, what does it matter?
Well, I do think, and it's very poignant to me, that people have a sense that certain habits might act like little golden keys. Mm-hmm. So perhaps the morning is a little golden key, and perhaps a pen to paper is a little golden key instead of a keyboard, and all kinds of superstitions and half-imagined ideas. The truth is everyone's different, and people have to experiment with what works for them until they get it the way they like it. Mm-hmm. I have this wonderful piece of news related to that, which is that a collection of essays of mine about the writing life was just accepted by the University of Notre Dame Press, the same people that published the collection In Envy Country.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. I am so happy. The name of the collection is Because You Have To, A Writing Life.
Oh.
And in the title, I hope people will understand
the
question that's implicit. And the answer really does stand for an entire way of life.
Yes.
There's no choice in the matter. If you could stop, you would, but you can't. And everything is about pushing along that continuum that we were just talking.
And it's kind of lonely at times.
Oh, my goodness. It's a bitterly lonely gig. And there are two kinds of loneliness, which is one of the things I try to talk about in that collection. One is the self-exile that most writers are very happy to do. Very peaceful, serene, insulated piece in which you can get ideas and get them down and watch them grow. It's sort of like watching a dream unfold. That kind of loneliness, I think most writers choose. But the other kind that's harder is getting attention for your work and getting recognition and getting it seen and taken by publishers. That's harder, and you do feel kind of crazy then. Like perhaps you've imagined that it is worth looking at, and maybe you're really a fraud, and all kinds of self-incriminating, haunting thoughts start to filter through. And that's when writers look hungrily for community.
Yes.
In myriad forms.
Yes, and wish that they didn't have to write. You're the answer to the question, because I have to. And you think, oh, do I have to at that point?
It's a good thing writers have exercise now instead of martinis.
Yes.
Although people do resort to the martinis, more like margaritas and beers now. I think writers are deliberately lighter weight in their alcohol consumption because they know the body is the instrument. And the body contains the brain, and you lose that, you've lost the game.
And also, we've seen a history of writers whose careers were ruined.
Wrecked.
By self-indulgence.
Cut down. And in their primes, too. And some of the writers I loved best, one was James Agee.
Yes.
Whom I adored.
Yes. Yes.
And all the other famous names that we know about, Hemingway, Dylan Thomas.
Yes.
Heaven knows who else. So I know a lot of modern writers are not only not interested in doing that, they're interested in prolonging health and clarity.
Mm-hmm.
So you find people like John Irving, who I think is a professional wrestler or something close to that. And almost all the writers I meet at colonies and on the road are runners, swimmers, cyclists, the whole thing, the full gamut.
The full gamut,
yeah.
Right. They say that every writer has her reader and every reader has her writer. And as I was reading you, I think, oh, she wrote this for me.
Oh.
I think one of the things that in which you really spoke to me in your work was your locations.
Hmm.
Your stories are written here where we live.
They are.
I mean, I could look out the window and see that landscape.
They are.
If I chose
and I'm
to.
So glad it spoke to you that way.
Yes.
Now, I admit that sometimes places that I have written about are conglomerates.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in The Great Far Away, the little novel.
Yes.
There is a city there that people would come to me and say, I couldn't decide, was it Sonoma or Healdsburg? And I would say, well, it was a kind of glom of the two.
Yes.
And people would have to be happy with that.
Yes.
And they'd already been arguing with each other and placing bets about it. There's a funny ether between people's imaginings of what they read.
Yes.
The world that they themselves create when they read.
Mm-hmm.
And then what the author may or may not have had in mind.
Mm-hmm.
There's always an odd ether. And the author who witnesses this disconnect a few times finally is very gentle when people ask her how much of that is true or where was that really?
Mm-hmm.
Was that based on so-and-so? Then you have to say, I heard Elizabeth Strout, who wrote the wonderful linked story series Olive Kitteridge.
Oh, yes. You know, I was going to ask you about
Olive
Kitteridge.
I love her. I love Elizabeth, and I love her work. She's incredibly generous. She's been kind to me.
Yes.
And Olive, I thought, was a marvelous character and superb collection. And when I went to a reading to watch people admire her and listen to her read, and after the reading, someone raised their hand and said, so was Olive based on someone you knew even a little? And Elizabeth looked very mysterious and guru-like and said, oh, Olive belongs to you now.
Oh, that's a good answer.
That was her answer.
I wanted to talk with you a little bit about the book you just mentioned, The Great Far Away, which is written of the recent past when young people were lighting out for the territory.
Yes, of a certain generation.
Yes.
Yes.
And setting up these hippie communities.
I have had such an interesting response to that because I based it, actually, I based it on an area not local to Sonoma County, but I moved it to Sonoma County and then made up places within the county, feeling that all of it was incredibly parochial, that is, limited to the finite turf I was describing. And then readers would write to me from upstate New York and say, I know you base that on where I spent my formative years.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently it was a nationwide demographic phenomenon.
I'm sure it was.
And that really impressed me. I hadn't considered it, but once I thought about it, it did make sense.
And there's a certain sadness in that there is a built-in tendency to self-destruct. I was so impressed with the way you brought that into the community. It was a sort of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I'm always looking for the snake that will eventually intrude and spoil the whole thing. And that two of the characters who were admirable characters started carrying on a liaison, thinking that their partners wouldn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that infidelity ate away at the trust in the community until when it was finally revealed, the community was no longer a community.
Right. Well, it had evolved elsewhere anyway, simultaneously. You know, Rosemary, one of the things that most interests me in work that I admire and which I hope very much to capture and create in my own work is the quality of inevitability.
Yes.
Of the human trajectory.
Yes.
In relationship, in age, in aging, in sex, in the arc, the path that must be traveled, whether we like it very much or not.
Yeah.
If, it seems to me, a work conveys that inevitable quality, and I'll give you my favorite example, which is a book that I idolize called So Long, See You Tomorrow by the late venerable writer William Maxwell, whom many, many authors revere.
Yes.
That book had a very sad trajectory, but there was something so exhilarating about the truthfulness of it.
Yes.
That the reader comes away breathless with containing something larger, being understanding something larger. Mm-hmm. And whatever we understand as larger, in my opinion, has to do with that inevitable quality. I used to call it, for lack of a better word, the ways things go. In fact, I even thought about using that as a title somewhere. It's that basic.
Yes.
There's something about recognizing the truth of the ways things go, meaning fall out, proceed toward their own ruin, contain the seeds of their own ruin. I like following that in other people's work, and I hope to convey it in my own. And The Great Far Away was a passionate effort to do that.
Yes.
And also to try to show that once we are older and we look back on the denouement of idyllic periods of our lives like that, we understand, after enough time, that there's no blame to lay any more than we can blame our parents for tragedies they may have effected, for divorces or deaths. It's like almost like human lives are sort of small supernovas.
Mm-hmm.
Each explodes, goes off in different ways. All of that inevitability, it seems to form a large repeating pattern, and it interests me very much as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
I want to frame it and look very, very closely at it and be made larger when we understand it better. I do believe that books that matter enter us in the body. They come into our bodies and they live in our bodies forever,
mm-hmm.
even if we don't remember necessarily particulars of what a story was about. We remember a feeling it gave. Mm-hmm.
And in your art, you respect that inevitability. As an artist, you don't try to mess it, to make it do what you want to do.
Oh, no.
You let that arc do what needs to be
done. Yeah, it tells you.
Yes.
And if you try to mess with it, something smells bad.
That's right.
And readers know immediately.
Readers know immediately.
It feels contrived,
yeah.
And the reader feels handled. Because
mm-hmm.
dishonesty is a bad smell in
That's
literary
right.
fiction.
That's right. So. I want to read a paragraph that illustrates for me what we've been talking about, illustrates it so beautifully.
Oh, this
it's from
great.
Almost the end of The Great Far Away. One of the couples who he has been the transgressor and she has just been made aware of it. And she said, "I have no way of coming out of this," she said slowly. Nothing was to be the same. And that was in many ways a relief. But the dawning comprehension that she was guilty, guilty by default, made her blink in wonder. Though he had obliterated the city of their marriage in a slow sandstorm, it was she who would be blamed. She would be seen as having failed, being insufficient to him. That was the first assumption. He'd had to seek for sufficiency elsewhere. Therefore, her fault, an equation. Any court of human law would rule it. No division of responsibility, Chips. You were charged with the crime of your own loss. Loss and blame came at you from both ends of the same event, a two-headed snake. I am Alma, insufficient to my husband, crook, loser. Occupation, faller.
Thank you. It's thrilling to hear you read it.
What woman
Thank you.
Has not felt that way who's been through a divorce? Alma was very wise in coming to that realization a lot more quickly than most of us do. Most of us spend a lot of time flailing against it, but perhaps because of the life she'd lived there in community, her wisdom was such that she knew that and accepted it and got on with her life.
Wow. I'm made to see it in afresh, thanks to you.
And when I read that, I thought, how did she know that?
Wow.
But, of course, it's what you've just described. It's you recognize the inevitable.
It's coming at you, as they say. I hardly remember now being that deeply in Alma's head, but I was.
Mm-hmm.
And when you read those words, I suddenly remembered,
mm-hmm.
which is something an author does, and I guess without knowing how deeply she's gone, which is probably merciful, because otherwise she might panic for want of oxygen.
That's right.
And scramble for the surface. But lines like that come from being so deeply in the
yeah.
woman's head
mm-hmm.
and thinking, right, what does it feel like? And what's the first thing you think? And what's the next thing? And what's
mm-hmm.
the next?
Mm-hmm.
I love that you picked those lines. Thank you.
And you were writing from the standpoint of an older woman who was looking back on the events.
Absolutely.
And I think that enabled you from that point of view to go more deeply into Alma's head, because the protagonist who was speaking had a lifetime to think it over and to remember Alma.
To sift it and weigh it.
Yes.
And if you probably noticed that the epigraph for the novel is from Willa Cather, and it was actually from the woman Sarah Orne Jewett, who was writing a letter to Cather. She was sort of a mentor to Cather, and I think also a long-term partner. And she wrote, "One must know the world before one can know the parish."
Mm-hmm.
That sang to me, because in the years when I was living those characters and those stories, I remember thinking that they were the world, in the sense that my life was delimited to how well I succeeded or failed, or how badly I failed within that tiny world. Later, I understood that they were a microcosm. It helped to know the world, but they were not at all the world. Mm-hmm. The world was much larger and more capacious. There was room to reinvent oneself, which is something people outside the United States accuse Americans of, but I still do believe Americans quite capable of doing it.
Yes.
We reinvent ourselves all the time, and many quite successfully.
Mm-hmm.
So to be far enough now from those years of what did for me cause a lot of pain and make it into art was a great release and a great gift. It also, if this makes any sense, amplifies the fund of compassion you have for watching similar dramas unfold before you as you go on, and they always are.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host, and my guest is Joan Frank. Joan is here in the studio, and we're talking about her work. We've just been talking about The Great Far Away, a novella about the nostalgia of the time when young people went off to live in tents.
I want to tell you about where the title came from.
Yes.
Someone once asked the painter Georgia O'Keeffe what it was she painted. What was the provenance? The soul, the gist, the substance of her painting? And she answered, "The Great Far Away." I knew as soon as it came to me that that was what I wanted to call this story. I feel tenderly toward the story, and I hope it stays in the world and that people look at it, especially now thanks to you.
The first story of yours that I read, it's in the book In Envy Country, Betting on Men.
Uh-oh.
Betting on Men.
Yes, ma'am.
I've always wondered why I don't get a chance to read more stories about what happens in the workplace.
Exactly true.
And I think one reason is because of all the silliness on the television. And people think, oh, now I know all about the workplace because I watch Mad Men or one of those silly comedies.
That's probably
comedies.
A good part of it.
Yes.
The other part is I think people think it's too deadly dull.
Yes.
Too deadly dull to have any redeeming value whatsoever in any way. It was so much a part of my life. All of my days I have worked administrative assistant jobs.
Oh, that's how you know this
all
so well.
All of my days.
Yes.
And I have endured pancake piles of irony.
Yes.
And had nowhere to put it.
Yes.
Until... Well, at some point there must have been a not too small implosion, and I must have felt, right, this is going to be recorded. I'm going to frame this, and I'm going to show people the zoo of it.
The silly games, the politics, the rivalries.
But you see, Rosemary, because it's all underwritten by staggering amounts of money.
That's what reminded me in your story.
That's the bottom line.
The money that's being wasted.
It's the bottom line, and no one argues with money.
Yes.
Remember that line about whoever takes the most toys home wins?
That's right.
Well, the same is true of the money. So the gentlemen who are running the show and selling things for incomprehensible amounts of money are the ones taken seriously in our world, and particularly in an American
That's right.
Reality.
Yes. I admire the delicious subversity in your writing.
I must tell you, it was incredibly cathartic to write. And I'm not saying that writing stories and literary fiction is psychotherapeutic, because I do believe that that's a different set of functions. But I can't deny that there is some stuff that you are just cackling to write. Mm-hmm. I read it with other writers too. For example, Margaret Atwood.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
She has a good time.
Oh, yes.
And you can see that she's having a good time.
Yes.
I had a good time with this one. It was deeply satisfying.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad I spoke to you.
Because I felt like, oh, she's writing my story. Oh, I know these people.
You know, other women have said the same thing to me. Yes. I just felt like that's a wonderful validation. Mm-hmm. It's like a flag flying.
Yes.
To hear.
And this story, Betting on Men, it is a classic.
Thank you.
And these.
Thank you. I have to tell you, it was nominated for a Pushcart Prize.
Good.
And that's pretty high up there.
Yes, that's right up there.
Litland, which made me very happy.
Yes.
Very happy.
Well, and your publications are in marvelous places.
They are.
I mean, they're so well
proud
placed
of them.
In the top literary journals.
Thank you, dear.
They're all over
Thank
the place.
You. My goal, though, Rosemary, I'll confess it to you and the public, is to crack that glass ceiling between small and literary press publishing and a major sale to a major house. Mm-hmm. It's very, very hard for literary fiction to affect.
That's right.
Literary fiction is sort of the tar baby mm-hmm. of the publishing
yes.
world, and much more so now that the economy has derailed and publishers are frantic.
Mm-hmm.
They're just frantic.
I know it is frantic, and you can see that from what they publish.
You can see it, you can feel it, you can read
yes.
it, and it's kind of like the stock exchange. People are hysterical,
yes, precisely.
Shouting and screaming, and they're trying to. It's also like a horse race, and
mm-hmm.
people are trying to guess what horse is going to
yes.
win or place or
mm-hmm.
show,
right.
and they're trying to place bets on those horses. And
mm-hmm.
once in a while, they make an accurate bet. The rest of the time is chaos.
Mm-hmm. And they think if the book has 500 pages, then people will think it's worth
$36
right. and will buy it.
Right.
I really think that so many of the bestsellers are way, way too long.
And
yes,
for some reason, with authors whose names are considered clout
yes.
driven or likely good sellers, editors are fear to touch them somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And more than once I've thought, where was the editor? Where was the editor here?
That's right.
Somebody to kind of clean this up a little.
Clean this up a little,
right. Oh, dear.
You're listening to A Novel Idea. We're having such a good time. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host, and Joan Frank and I are talking it over, talking about her books and life in general and publishing and writing. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back.
Let's get back to Rosemary Manchester in conversation with Joan Frank. From KRCB, it's A Novel Idea.
Joan, when we met, I managed to find out a few things about things you've done in your life. And I remember you saying that you went to the Peace Corps.
I did.
To Senegal.
Yeah, I did. I went to West Africa, Senegal. I was very young.
Yes.
And the position that I was training for was called assistant social, which is social assistant. And basically it was a cover-all title for everything from weighing babies to teaching basic reading to mostly young mothers to giving out anti-malarial drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And also trying to teach basics of nutrition and sanitation.
Mm-hmm.
Because although the Senegalese had the ingredients for eating relatively well, they had peanuts and grain, which would be able to keep people alive, they didn't understand about combining them, and they didn't understand about germs because they couldn't be seen.
Couldn't see them. Mm-hmm.
And sadly, at the time, the infant mortality rate was 50%.
Oh.
Even though people were the Senegalese were some of the handsomest and kindest,
yes.
most joyful people I ever
yes.
knew, and I made some lovely friends there. The downside of all this is that all us young volunteers, mostly women, were incredibly young. We were like 20, 21 years old.
Mm.
And while we were idealistic and strong and healthy, for the most part, we weren't prepared emotionally for the remoteness
yes.
and the difficulty of persuading a culture which was deeply entrenched in a kind of exhausted lassitude and the opposite of motivation.
Yes.
The ways Americans move and think and tackle problems, unheard of right. at the time there. Some of the volunteers fell in love with their African instructors, who were young, handsome university students from the University of Dakar. And a lot of time was spent feeling desperately lonely and yes. listening to Carole King tapes and crying and crying and crying.
Yes.
So we did a lot of that. I would recommend, though, that a stage, as the French call it, a period of time in a third world country, be assigned to every young person in every college and even community college situation mm-hmm. in the country, because there is nothing to equal the shock of edification, the awareness of seeing and smelling and standing in a third world venue.
I thoroughly agree with you.
And the heroism of the people yes. given the terrible odds against mm-hmm. them.
Yeah.
It was an electrocuting education mm-hmm. and one I've never forgotten. I've
yes.
never forgotten the people and friends there.
Now, you and I share that experience years
oh,
in Africa
oh, goodness.
As young people. And this may be a stretch, but it seemed to me that it affects your writing. I saw the compassion in your writing, particularly for the women mm-hmm. who were stuck in mm-hmm. these office positions. Mm-hmm. And you didn't launch into self-analysis to do that. And you had a deeper understanding of the world. Mm. And maybe that's, you know, if you don't know the world, you don't know the parish. Maybe it goes right back to that. And perhaps I pick this up because I do this all the time myself, of feeling what you think you're suffering. The people in the third world are suffering much more than that.
Always.
It doesn't come through blatantly like that, mm-hmm. but it's just a feeling of the wider world.
Hmm.
And
you know, Rosemary, I'd never thought about it, but it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and the thought of the wastefulness of our society in lives, in
yes.
money, in time.
Well, you know, you're thinking probably also of Betting on Men because it's touched on there.
Mm-hmm.
If you recall, the protagonist goes into an electronics store.
Yes.
A television is on showing Burma.
That's right.
And a
That's
bunch
right.
of workers are hauling stones in
yes.
mud.
Yes.
In Burma.
Yes.
And she suddenly becomes aware of the graphic obscenity
yes.
of the level of wealth of the world that she herself is partaking of, even as its flunky. And that is the underpinning mm-hmm. perspective, perhaps, under many of these stories. It's true that Americans have the luxury of emotional problems. Elsewhere, that isn't a level of problem that can be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
The level of problem is mortal survival.
And yet the African people have a joyfulness.
True. Against all odds.
Against all odds that I don't find in very many Americans.
It's true.
We're such whiners.
It's true. It's true. And navel gazers.
Yes.
And who knows what collusion of history and cultural effects added up to this. But it's not an aspect of us that I'm really proud of, and I'm always thinking that most Americans should have to do some service of some kind to get perspective.
Have you written about that at all?
Not yet. But I have, what's the word, squirted it into short stories yes. and essays in this book that's coming, because you have to. There's a piece in it about money and my relationship to money my whole gosh darn life. And it's one of those essays which is done in numbered paragraphs so that there's lots of air floating between each statement. And at a certain point in the essay, after going through all the craziness of never really having much and having worked many administrative jobs for wealthy people, noticing their not exactly attractive habits, there's a point where the bottom falls out and I remember the fact of second and third world countries where mortal safety is rarely guaranteed and the struggle is very much on the surface to survive. There's an image of a woman, a young woman, emaciated young woman, nursing an infant with one hand holding the baby to the breast, the other stretched out begging for alms in front of the Hagia Sophia, which is the famous mosque in Istanbul. Those images never go away, and they are, should be, always humbling, chastening. They should be with us. They should live in our bodies and minds and inform everything we say and do. And perhaps to some degree,
I think they do.
That's what you're picking up.
With
as
those
well.
Of us who've been there
yeah.
and seen it for ourselves.
I'm glad that you say that
yeah.
and bring that up, Rosemary.
Yeah.
yeah. Very glad.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, this is a real jump, is your Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing. And you were doing some writing at the point. You, in fact, you had one book published, didn't you, before?
Well, yeah, I had a collection of essays that I try not to draw attention to anymore called Desperate Women Need to Talk to You.
What a title.
It's a great title. And you know, that was an ad for sex in the Chronicle.
Oh, my goodness.
And I just cut off the word wild. It was the original line was wild, desperate women need to talk to you. So I thought, just cut off the wild and have desperate in there, because I loved the irony at the time that desperate advertising sex was one thing. Mm-hmm. Desperate advertising desperate was something that could clear a room in 5 minutes. So those were essays that had mainly been published already in National Magazine, Sunday magazines. And they were journalism, and I liked them and was pleased for them at the time. But after that, I sensed that I was missing an enormous dimension by sticking with journalism, which tends to organize information all at the flat surface.
Yes, yes.
And tends also to goose itself up with hyper-cleverness and clever spinnings of language that don't really give painful insight into the soul of or the complicated dimensions of stories, the trajectories that don't always end well. Journalism couldn't treat that except as a documentary or expose, and I thought it was probably time to get into fiction. So I began to study with Thaisa Frank, who is no relation, an author who teaches at UC Berkeley Extension and has several beautiful books under her name. And I began to write short stories with Thaisa, and I began to send them out into the world. And they were accepted, to my delight, in good literary reviews. And after a time, I went to a writer's conference and met Antonia Nelson and Robert Boswell, and the both of them taught at the Warren Wilson MFA program for writers in North Carolina, and they said, you know, you might want to think about this. And at the time, I was so lost and frightened. I wasn't sure what the right path was, and this was all terribly momentous. I really needed a crystal ball and a genie, but instinct told me it was probably worth the risk, and I went, and it was a feast. It was taught by working writers who were generous and passionately committed, and there, all the students were many ages there and many, many backgrounds, but everyone was very, very serious about making good work. That was the thing that held everyone together. So I wrote for them, and I used stories that I already had as well. And by the time I popped out of there, I had a body of work that could stand as a little first collection. And that was the collection Boys Keep Being Born, which I tried at first to find an agent for, learned that agents consider story collections poison. Yes. They always want a novel first, so I thought, okay, I will try to place this myself. And I marched into the world offering this thing. And finally, the University of Missouri Press, bless them, said, yes, we will take it. And that was the great getting up morning of the beginning of a career in literary fiction.
Yes.
And the thing about this is, which I also write about in this book that's coming, because you have to, and I hope when it comes out we can talk again.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it's full of salacious, kind of scandalous truths that most writers don't talk about because they don't want to bum out people. But I find it very dishy.
Sounds like my kind of book.
It's very dishy to say, look, here's what goes on behind a little green curtain.
Yes.
You know, it's wonderful to have books coming out with small literary and university presses who are truly the heroes of arts and letters in our time, in America particularly. They are taking the new writers. They're taking emerging writers. They're risking who knows how they stay alive. They may, like the dancer Twilla Tharp, live on a small container of yogurt a day. But they're doing it. If it weren't for them, I don't know how we'd be carrying on. My dream, though, like Pinocchio, from going from a wooden puppet to a flesh and blood little boy, is to get a sale for maybe a small amount of money, just a little bit of money, to an actual major publishing house. And by major, I think of Farrar, Straus, Giroux, Houghton Mifflin, Knopf, and so on and so on. I'm not expecting the world to stop if that should happen, and I'm not expecting bucket loads of money. They always say anything pays better than writing. But it would be a quality of legitimacy that would make me feel that a signpost had been arrived at, a milestone.
I feel like validation.
Yeah.
Yes. Isn't that interesting how it comes to us through recognition.
Externals.
Somebody big.
Externals, right. Alas. Mm-hmm. In the end, though, the writer has to always find it in herself,
yes,
to push on, carry on. And externals can be non-existent, and you still have to push. Mm-hmm. You have to push.
Mm-hmm. And your advice to writers out there would be keep pushing.
And keep well. Take care of your health, because without it, you've nothing.
That's
the
right.
Brain is encased in the body. No romantic obliteration of the senses. You know, take up a sport, take up yoga, keep very strong and well, because not only do you need health to conceive, to make the work and to polish the work and produce shapely, dimensional, reverberant, light-emanating art, but you need then to go into the world and do what Thaisa Frank calls setting up a booth in the marketplace. You need to fight very hard for it to get your work seen and taken by the places that matter. That is a tough, tough fight. It's not easy.
That the work isn't over when you finish the
writing.
Oh,
goodness, no. Then
the
real
begins.
Work begins. The true delight is in making work. This is my
that's
contention.
Right.
And then the marketing, that's another room. You shut the door to the making room, and you open the door to the marketing room, where there is good coffee, some inspiring music, and a lot of paper and envelopes and stamps, or latterly, a lot of email and electronic submission.
And the support of good friends.
And every writer has a little coterie of people who have known her or him since the beginning and said, you go. Mm-hmm. Keep doing it. Mm-hmm. Keep going. And every writer, if he or she has any wits, thanks those people with full heart every time a piece of work is published.
Which,
they're the real heroes.
Which you do in your books very graciously.
Thank you for noticing.
It's lovely to see those. Thank you.
Thanks, Rosemary. What a pleasure it is to talk about
this
stuff.
I've enjoyed every minute, Joan. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. And Joan Frank has been my guest this evening. Her four books are, the latest one is In Envy Country, a collection of wonderful short stories. There's a novel we didn't even get to talk about called Miss Kansas City,
alas,
which I love.
Thank you.
Then there are Boys Keep Being Born. And then The Great Faraway, four beautiful books. Thanks for writing those, Joan.
Oh, Rosemary, thanks for reading them and supporting them.
And thanks for coming into the studio to talk about them.
I hope we'll do it again soon.
We will. We'll do it again.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you, Rosemary Manchester, talking with Joan Frank. Bart Schneider, who is a friend of A Novel Idea, you may recall him talking about his books Beautiful Inez and Man in the Blizzard. Well, Bart has launched a new press, Kelly's Cove, with several strong initial offerings. I caught up with Bart recently at the Sonoma County Book Festival. Let's listen to part of my conversation with him there.
Well, first of all, Kelly's Cove is the beach right below the Cliff House in San Francisco. So it's the northernmost part of the ocean in San Francisco, and right before the Golden Gate begins. And it's where I grew up. I mean, I grew up 10 blocks from there. And so it's kind of nice to honor the place. I wanted to make a very local press that featured Northern California writers, both living and dead, and have the books nicely designed with covers by California painters so that they'd be distinctive. And I figured that in a time, you know, at this point in the history of publishing, it seems like you have to have some kind of strategic notion of why you should exist when everybody else is rushing into the ebook format and trying to figure out how to capture readers anywhere but in print. So it's a counterintuitive venture. I'm beginning to think I might be onto something, but I'm also full of doubt. Like, what kind of fool are you, dude, to think you can do what everybody else has figured out is dead?
So what are your first offerings?
I was very happy to find out that Kenneth Patchen, the great poet, painter, experimenter, reader with jazz back from the 50s and 60s, who was so terrifically influential in the 50s and 60s, was celebrating his centennial. I don't know how actively he's celebrating it, but that this was, in fact, his centennial, and that nobody was bringing out any collection to commemorate that. So that seemed like a really good opportunity, and I found a wonderful guy down in Palo Alto, or Menlo Park, who had been Patchen's literary executor, had been a teenager when he had been befriended by Patchen. This is a guy named Jonathan Clark, who ended up editing a centennial selection of Kenneth Patchen's work. And he has paintings that nobody has seen before of Patchen's, that we have, a very beautiful collection with 16 pages of color, and something that honors Patchen well. Then I went into the Wayback Machine and pulled out a couple of volumes from Ambrose Bierce, the veteran San Francisco reporter thought of as a misanthrope, who actually was a young man, 19, when he signed up for the Civil War, and has written probably the greatest fiction to come out of the Civil War experience. I mean, there might have been Stephen Crane's work is formidable, but he was born after the Civil War, and Bierce wrote short stories only, and this collection of short stories is one of his commentators, or one of his critics said, this is some of the great anti-war writing, and 6, 7, 8 page stories that really bring it, and they kind of anticipate somebody like Hemingway in his early war writing of the 20s, and these stories were written mostly, all the stories in this collection were published originally in the San Francisco Examiner one at a time as a feature, and they were mostly written in the 1880s.
What made you decide to gravitate towards Ambrose Bierce?
Everybody sort of knows about Bierce but doesn't know him. A lot of people know The Devil's Dictionary, so I did an edition of The Devil's Dictionary, which I'm calling the best of The Devil's Dictionary, and I snipped out a lot of his larger pieces of... He has invented poets that write doggerel after some of the definitions, and he has invented scholars, and I snipped out a lot of that, so it's a pretty usable... I mean, they're wonderful, wonderful definitions, and I think they'll grab people anew more than 100 years after they were written. And I'm trying to do something with it that I push the idea of the definitions into the 21st century by inviting... We compiled at the back of that book a list of a lot of 21st century words that... or late 20th century words that Bierce didn't get a chance to define, and try to get people to contribute to our website to a 21st century Devil's Dictionary. So, and it's fun to imagine how Bierce would deal with a word like bling or multitasking, and even conventional words that he didn't define, like abortion or circumcision. I'm just trying to make the stuff as living today as I possibly can, especially the historic things. And with the Bierce, I've taken it a step further, and I've written a one-person show for an actor that I've been working with developing it, called Bierce Returns. And it's great San Francisco actor Felix Justice, who's happens to be an African-American, and at exactly the age that Bierce was when Bierce disappeared, which was 71. I think Felix is actually a year older. And Felix is going to be performing Bierce Returns at several bookstores in the Bay Area. And it's fun to have written a black Bierce.
That was Bart Schneider at the Sonoma County Book Festival, where I caught up with him. Some other books from Kelly's Cove include Terry Arrett's latest volume, Night Sky Journey, and Mike Tuggle's What Lures the Foxes, along with Bart's book of poems, Morning Opera. Terry, Bart, and Mike will be making several appearances in Sonoma County. Friday, October 14th at 7 at the Occidental Center for the Arts. On Sunday, the 16th at 2:30 at Reader's Books in Sonoma. And at the River Reader in Guerneville on Sunday, October 23rd at 2:30. Bart's play, Bierce Returns with Felix Justice as Ambrose Bierce, shows October 23rd at 2:30 at Reader's Books in Sonoma. By the way, Bart's companion book to Man in the Blizzard, Nameless Dame, will appear in March of next year. Now, if all that isn't enough, let's welcome Events Director of Copperfields Books, Katie Casbin, to fill us in on other literary happenings around the county.
I am so pleased to bring you information about October. It has been a great summer, and now we are getting into fall, and we have some amazing events coming up in October. But before I get into the events, I just want to tell everyone that we have a new website, and anything that you might miss on this broadcast, you can go to our website, which is copperfieldsbooks.com, and we also have a newsletter there that you can sign up for. And the cool thing about the newsletter is that we're not going to overspam you, but we'll tell you what cool books are coming up, especially getting ready for Christmas, great gift ideas, coupons, things like that. Plus, this is a great way to keep abreast of what's happening in your local community with your independent bookstore. So, for October, we have James Dashner, The Death Cure. This is a kids' event in Petaluma. That's on October 13th. October 14th at the Wells Fargo Center, we are very happy to support Mary Oliver and her poetry. So please come out to that. You can get information at the Wells Fargo website. Then we have on Sunday, October 16th in Petaluma, at 2 p.m., Carmina Salcido. And this is a really intense story. You're going to want to come with your family to this one. This is called Not Lost Forever, My Story of Survival. Then Amy Cortez on Monday, October 17th. This is going to be a fantastic event for everyone who is interested in locavesting. So the revolution in local investing and how to profit from it. So this, I think, is going to be great for Sonoma County. Very excited about that. Then on Tuesday, October 18th, Antonia Juhas is coming with Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. That is going to be at the Community Church of Sebastopol, 1000 Gravenstein Highway North, at 7 p.m. That is co-sponsored by the Santa Rosa Peace and Justice Center. On that same night in our Sebastopol store, Jennifer Arnold is coming with In a Dog's Heart. So if your puppies are well-behaved, they can come into the store and they might get a treat. It's a great book for lovers of dogs. Then The Bohemian has their Java Jive this year, Wednesday, October 19th at 6 p.m. That's going to also be in Sebastopol. They're the winners from The Bohemian's annual Java Jive writing contest. Will be reading their winning entries. On Saturday, October 22nd at 7 p.m., stay in Sebastopol for Howard Charing, The Ayahuasca Visions of Pablo Amaringo. So this guy lives in Peru most of the time and has an incredible, beautiful book with hand-illustrated drawings from Pablo Amaringo and his ayahuasca visions. We also have El Día de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead. Lots of events happening in Petaluma. October 23rd, 3 to 5:30 p.m. Petals and Bones are going to be having a creative writing workshop. So I know this is a lot of information. So again, check the website. You can see all these events there. On the October 24th, we have another kids events. Then October 25th, Joel Salatin. Folks, this ain't normal. So we all love Joel Salatin, all the farmers around here. I hope everybody comes out. There's a limited number of tickets, so call the Petaluma store and get your book and your ticket today. Brian Selznick, for kids out there, Wonderstruck, that's going to be on October 26th at 10 a.m., also at the Mystic Theater in Petaluma. Then for the teens out there, this is going to be big, Tamara Pierce. That's right, Tamara Pierce in person will be at the Sebastopol store on Thursday, October 27th. Then on the 28th, on Friday, we have the YWCA's second annual Changing Hurt to Hope. It's writers speaking out against domestic violence. This is going to be at Montgomery Village and is going to be an amazing event. So hopefully everybody can come out and support the YWCA for that.
Thank you, Katie Casbin and Bart Schneider. And thanks to Joan Frank. And we have a few moments left. Let's listen to Joan give us another delicious reading. I'm Suzanne Lang.
And I'm Rosemary Manchester.
It's a novel idea.
In Envy Country, the title story. When Lena Macy went to the Ryerson's house, she always felt vaguely shamed, a supplicant. Only in their early 40s, Dick and Karen Ryerson had already arrived at a station in life, let's be clear, had built that station with luck and prescience, which seemed embarrassingly fabulous. Simply mounting the stairs to their mansion, yes, a bona fide mansion, with cement relief fleur-de-lis bannering each cupola, could fluster the most accomplished visitor. For the stairs angled so steeply and climbed so high, it was a mansion on a hill, of course, in a choice old neighborhood of this much romanticized city, that one arrived at the doorbell out of breath. If you turned to look back in the ocean-chilled night, out over the tangled sloping garden, morning glories, poppies, daisies, past the quiet streets with their cold saline breezes, you saw a city spread to the bay, black velvet cloth sprinkled with chips of diamonds and pearls, long pins of sparkling points. Some tiny few of these moved along the milky sheen of water in the distance under the moon. Lords of all they survey, Lena would think. The heavy carved front door had a decorative window of leaded glass, a thin slot through which the insider might size up the outsider quicker than the reverse. Within, Patsy, the fluffy toy poodle, barked voicelessly, a frustrated laryngeal sound. Her bark and ovaries had been removed, Karen's promise to Dick when the animal was purchased. When Dick and Karen expected guests, they thought nothing of leaving the door unlocked. Perhaps no thief would dare attempt all those stairs under the hot porch lights. And sometimes Lena would softly let herself in. A grand living room opened up before her, warm and bright and perfectly empty. Magazines scattered over the Koa coffee table, fireplace percolating, thick Turkish rugs over the polished hardwood floor. Two deep sofas, two puffy armchairs piled with extra cushions, all in rich creams and autumn golds. The ceiling loomed 20 feet above, curved at its corners in the manner of early century Victorians. It was the scale of things at the Ryerson's that had always undone her, Lena decided. Lena came from a lifetime of small apartments and cottages. By her own admission, found it hard to give up the mentality, though now, living with Phil, she was long past official grounds for it. It was more an ingrained habit, the minimalist reflex, living sparely and throwing the mass of your resources into a liquid emergency fund. You never knew when you might have to run away, went the secret refrain. It was so fundamental, so automatic over a lifetime of petty jobs of renting this or that. The slogan had become nearly unconscious, entered her as an actual definition of being after years of living alone with no net, as some put it. The Ryersons seemed, by contrast, to want to lean into large gestures. The heavy, expensive furniture announced intention of duration, like giant poles of a grand edifice sunk into that spot on earth. A huge oil portrait of the couple hung above the couch, painted by someone whose name could be found on no fewer than 5 concurrent national magazine covers. Lena couldn't help thinking of this portrait as the culmination of the Ryerson home's theme, the centerpiece toward which visitors automatically veered, respectful of the visionary founders. A separate dining room contained an antique oak table, rough-hewn yet of buttery and smooth surface. It ran the length of the room with matching high-backed chairs. Karen had bought it from a couple who'd thought they were moving, who'd then found they weren't. There'd come an interval of seller's remorse. The couple had missed the table and asked whether there might be any chance that Karen would sell it back. There hadn't. And even though Lena hated formal dinner parties and would have broken into a sweat just to overhear the purchase price of much of what she gazed upon in the Ryerson home, something in her would wince as she stared at the warm, lavish appurtenances of the mansion. "Why haven't you made a comparable life?" went the hissed indictment, though in fact this never made sense. Lena had more than enough.